Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, how we'll live in the suburbs of the future. And if the words white, bland, and boring just popped into your head, you need to get out more. You're giving the suburbs a bad rap. As our roundtablers contemplate where the burbs are headed, I want to hear from you, especially if you're 40 and under. Are you a millennial who has moved to or always lived in the burbs? What's the attraction? And if you're 40 and older, have you abandoned the burbs for the big city? Tell me why. Talk to me about this on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Maria Wardoku is a transportation planner for Alta Planning based in Minneapolis. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Eric Weiss is a long-range planner for the city of Shakopee and vice president of the American Planning Association. Eric, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
C. Terrence Anderson is equity manager for the Met Council. And Terrence, welcome. Good to have you here.
Happy to be here.
Terrence, I want to start with you because I think we have to zero in on this idea that the suburbs are what they were in the 1970s and the 1980s. And they were pretty much as I described in the introduction and said, hey, you're giving them a bad rap. They were bland. They were white. They were boring. How do they look today?
Yeah, I think the suburbs are changing quite a bit today. I think one of the things that we're seeing at the Met Council, I think one of the things that we're seeing across the nation is a rising level of poverty in the suburbs. As cities become more attractive, as they become the hip thing to do right now, often what that equates to is them becoming more expensive. And so I think part of that is so folks who can't afford to remain in the city are moving to the suburbs. So I think in the Twin Cities, it's too. I think you had Libby Starling, who was at the Met Council some time ago, or some folks from NPR did, and she talked about that specific thing. So I think one of the things that we've seen is over the last 12 years, actually now in the Twin Cities, there's more poverty in the suburbs than there are in the cities today.
Wow.
So I think that's one dynamic that we have to pay attention to.
Eric, that really surprises me. You're out there in Shakopee. You're trying to attract more people to Shakopee. Is the cost of living rising and making Shakopee and others inaccessible for people that were trying to escape that in the city?
Shakopee has prided itself traditionally on having an affordable housing stock for all types of workers, blue collar, white collar. We are starting to see and hear some issues with people saying that housing is becoming unaffordable.
You're concerned about that.
We are concerned about that. Part of that is just a greater housing mix. A lot of what's been developed has been traditionally kind of a one size fit all, single family homes, you know, 3, 4, or 5 bedroom homes. And we know that families are changing, that there's a lot more single people living in households. Household sizes have decreased, and the housing hasn't quite matched where the population is. So we're hearing and seeing that we do need to begin to change, that we do need to offer more opportunities for people, and that some of the housing is unaffordable for the jobs that are available out there.
So, Maria, this is, I think Eric has kind of put his finger on this too, this rap on one size fits all. That was also the traditional view of the suburbs. If you didn't have a family, your choices for living in the suburbs were pretty limited. Has that changed, or is that still mostly the issue with a lot of suburbs?
I think it's absolutely changing. I did a year-long project looking at the first-ring suburbs of the Twin Cities and the development that was happening there. And overwhelmingly, it's multifamily housing that's being developed now. Very few of those traditional suburban single-family subdivisions that you think of when you think of suburbs. But we're actually seeing some mixed-use development. We're seeing apartment buildings, building for seniors, building affordable housing. All different kinds of housing are going up in the suburbs right now.
And is that being driven by the fact that the cities, when people with more means began moving into the cities, people without as much means had to find somewhere else to live? I mean, is that mostly what's driving this?
I think in first-ring suburbs, what's driving it is just a lack of land. So they're held in on one side by the central city and on the other side by second ring suburbs and exurbs. So those first ring suburbs have no choice really but to build upwards because they don't have giant tracts of farmland that can be turned into.
So that's the multifamily housing. Is that happening in Shakopee, Eric?
We're seeing that to some degree. We do, you know, we're an outer ring suburb, so we have available green space green development that we are able to build new. So we are seeing a mix of single family homes, but also some apartments and townhomes that have been proposed. You know, we're still kind of coming out from a real estate perspective of the Great Recession. So
really, you're still seeing the effect of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
In Shakopee. How so? Yeah.
Development is just slower. You know, I think there was a pent up demand and now there's a limit on construction workers. Housing prices have gone up because of construction costs. The material costs have gone up. So we are still kind of coming out of that. I think the market has tended to focus on the luxury end of the market, whether that's the single family home end or apartments. And so that is where, while there's things happening, there's things that are being constructed, there is still that mismatch between the jobs and what the housing has
Terrence,
been
you're seeing that as well? The focus on the luxury end and not for people, again, who don't have the means of the people that have moved into the city.
Yeah.
What do you do about that?
Yeah, I think that's I do see that. I think anecdotally, you know, just as I drive around the metro, that seems to be what developers are focusing on. And I know I've seen that. I think that's true across the country. And so I think the hope that a lot of cities have is that as those luxury units are developed, the units filter down to become more affordable that have been existing for a long time and can maybe use a minor amount of development. And I think that is because construction costs are so high right now. I recently purchased a home.
In a suburb or in the city?
In the city, but I'm a suburb. I come from the suburbs, so believe me.
you grew up in the suburbs?
I did.
Okay,
I did.
All right.
But I looked to building a home. And the cost to build a reasonable home of what me as a millennial could afford, quite difficult to do. So I think most of it are luxury, multifamily units that are being built right now.
I'm curious, given your role in the Met Council, how you made this decision about where you were going to live. I mean, what were the pros? Why not go back out to the suburbs? That's choose the city?
That's a good question. So actually, I live in North Minneapolis, which I'm very proud of. I think I chose there because that's the place that I'm most comfortable. It's a place where I feel like the community reflects a lot of the values that I have of community. You know, my neighbors have been there for 40 years each, and I think I just love the idea of coming into that kind of community.
And did you feel like, hey, that's not necessarily the life I can get out in the suburbs?
Well, you know, I think there's the other things. I think we read our values into the physical environment like text, and I think part of the values that I have, you know, is if we're thinking about climate change is living in communities where I don't have to depend on my car as much, living in communities that are diverse if we're having a conversation about racism or whatever it is in society. So I felt like I don't think my community is the only place that reflects those values. And I think those values are reflected in a lot of the suburbs as well. This just happened to be the place that I chose.
I'm really glad you brought up the sustainability part of this, that being something that was important to you as you made a decision about this. So Maria, at the moment, it seems like this idea of sustainability in suburbs is kind of a mismatch. Maybe that's because I don't have knowledge of what suburbs are doing about this. So now that you've done this study, what have you found out about it?
Yeah, I have found actually a lot of surprising things are happening out in the suburbs.
Around sustainability.
Around sustainability.
Really?
There's a new development in St. Louis Park that is just starting construction right now. It's called Place, and it's marrying art with community, environment. It's oriented around transit and biking and walking, and it includes affordable housing for people who live in the community, people who are artists. So I think it's the most innovative development that's happening in the Twin Cities right now, and it's happening out in St. Louis Park, somewhere where people might not think to look for such an innovative development.
For sure. So when you say it's oriented around transit and community and sustainability, how?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the site design, it's on either side of the future Southwest LRT track, that's Southwest Light Rail.
Okay.
And along the bike pathway there, they're planting an urban forest. So they'll have an acre of forest there with public art incorporated into it.
Mm-hmm.
They're giving people discounts for not having a car. There's
just
innumerable ways that they're working towards sustainability.
I mean, that's the thing, Eric, that I think about is when you're using more land, in as I think you feel freer to do. I live in the suburbs. I wouldn't be living on the amount of land that I live on if I had chosen to live in the city. But I know that that's not as sustainable as I could be if I was not living in a suburb like that. I mean, how do you reconcile there's more room to sprawl, there's more land that gets unused with this idea of sustainability in suburbs?
Yeah, I think it's about figuring out how to find appropriate balance. I think as land costs go up and continue to go up, we will just see a natural decrease in the size of plots of homes. I think that's something that we, we're struggling with. There's a large section of the community that does want a larger yard, and we should figure out a way to accommodate that. We also know that there's a large section of the population that also wants to downsize. There's seniors that no longer want to maintain a large yard. And so looking for ways to provide opportunities for them to maybe downsize but still stay within the community.
But, I mean, do you feel that short of these planned communities, you can really sell sustainability in a suburb like Shakopee, where you can buy as big of a yard as acreage as you can basically afford?
I do. I think there's, I think that's one tool within the toolbox. And I think that there's ways to potentially mitigate some of those larger lots. I think, in Shakopee right now and throughout the metro, cities are completing their comprehensive plans, which is their long-range strategic plan.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, that's an opportunity to get feedback and a vision from the community and then determine in the next 20 years what are the projects that we're going to work on. From a sustainability standpoint, water is a huge issue. We know that in Minnesota, it's one of our biggest assets. And there are some benefits to having some larger lots, as long as you're not watering them all the time. Looking at ways to provide, opportunities for that water to not, decrease the amount of flooding that happens by allowing it to filter through the ground.
Terrence, how do you think about this? Suburb meets sustainability. Is it real?
I think it can be real, absolutely. I mean, I think it has to be intentional to be looked at through that paradigm. I think sustainability really is more complex than the general conversation that we have on it. I mean, yes, there is the size of the land, and that's very important, too. Of course, there's the materials that you use. But something I'm thinking about in my own house is the plants that I'm planting. I want to plant things like lavender and other flowers that are good for bees, and I think that's part of sustainability, how we care for the other parts of the environment beyond emissions. I think about, are you watering your lawn? Are you planting things that require less intervention into the natural resources in that environment that are part of it? Suburbs are just as much a part of that equation as I think that cities are. So it's not just the size, it's what you do with the size of that land, how the efficiency of what you use on that land, which I think some developments on suburbs are doing better than others.
Can cities or suburban governments control for that very much? What I'm saying is, if you move into a suburb, Eric, if you move into Shakopee and you buy a 5-acre lot, how much influence can the city government really have on how you use that and how sustainable you want to be? You know what I'm asking?
Sure. It depends. I think there, the city uses zoning regulation as its main tool to regulate land. I think there are some limits on what the city can do as far as zoning. But that is something that's a tool that we want to look towards to provide better places, better community, and think about sustainability. one thing that we're thinking about in Shakopee is our zoning regulations require, you know, a large amount of parking for retail areas. We're now seeing that a large part of those strip malls, that parking sits empty all year long. And so can we reduce that parking minimum to a point where they don't have to build such large parking lots that just sit empty? You know, can we reuse that land for housing or for more retail or for entertainment? I think that's just one of the ways. I think we can look at, you know, reducing setbacks. We can look at increasing density in certain areas of the city.
That's interesting that you might come in and reclaim some of the paved over parking that you thought had to go along with retail businesses, right?
I think it's less about reclaiming and providing more opportunities for private development to do what it wants or what the market will demand.
Well, okay, what are we talking about? So you've got some big parking lot in front of a retail space in Shakopee that isn't used most of the time. How could it be used?
So I think it could be used in a number of ways. Again, that's kind of what the zoning regulations would allow, but I think some outlot, you know, it could be a small restaurant, it could be more retail. Some communities are putting, you know, mixed use buildings where there's housing and retail mm-hmm. in their parking lots. Mm-hmm. We've even had a conversation in Scott County about church parking lots that sit empty, you know, for mostly 5 days of the week.
Yeah.
And
what would you do with a church parking lot potentially?
Well, we've been having some conversations about the lack of housing that's affordable to the average family. And so are there opportunities to do housing development in a church parking lot, which I know has taken place actually in Minneapolis?
Okay, how does that work?
You just take that excess land that isn't used or is used only on a, you know, Sunday morning and maybe
right.
Wednesday night,
uh-huh.
and you turn that into housing. You can provide parking underground or in a ramp, which obviously adds a cost to the development.
Right.
But a lot of it's just excess. A lot of it just sits empty.
Maria?
Yeah. So another approach is to look at district parking. So you can have the city or another entity playing a role where they're coordinating with, say, the church and the restaurant and the school, who all use parking at different times of the day, to allow them to develop a cooperative agreement so that they don't all have to each have their own parking lot. They can have one parking lot that's used for different purposes throughout the day.
Oh, I think it's about finding those efficiencies. You know, it's a recognition that is what we have now working. And if it's not working, let's find ways for greater efficiencies and to switch things up so that we do get the outcomes that we want.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable actually inspired by an article that I read, I think, in the Wall Street Journal about the suburbs of the future. And we invited three people that come in and talk about and think about these issues all of the time to have a conversation about what those suburbs look like. Maria Warduco is with us. She's a transportation planner for Alta Planning. And yes, we're going to talk about transit and transportation here. Eric Weiss is with us, long-range planner for the city of Shakopee. And C. Terrence Anderson with us, equity manager for the Met Council. And I'm asking you, as you listen into the conversation, are you a millennial who has moved to or always lived in the suburbs? What's the attraction for that? Is it as sustainable as you'd like it to be? And if you are 40 or older and you've abandoned the suburbs for the city, I'd like to know a little bit more about that decision that you made. You can tweet me at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Terrence, go ahead.
Well, you know, we're talking about millennials. What do these suburbs look like in the
right.
future? And so we're, you know, part of the conversation that we're having right now is how can we reimagine some of these spaces?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one of the favorite articles, you know, that I think folks love to write about millennials is, what are we killing these days?
Yeah.
You know, what were you talking about? Napkins?
Yeah, we've killed napkins.
Killed
the
napkin
industry.
Cereal.
Sorry, Applebee's, right? You know, uh-huh. You know, those are a lot of things that folks are talking about millennials killing. And so I think I would imagine that cities and other, you know, suburbs that are thinking about this question is trying to project, what do millennials want? Less chain restaurants, more of kind of these individualized, you know, these restaurants I always think is kind of more of an art than it is cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those different sort of things. And I think those require different types of development than I think were expected for
like what?
Before.
Yeah.
Right. So, not, you know, maybe it means less of the, you know, big strip malls, because that's you know, maybe the less parking lots, and that could be one decision that one makes, and more into some of these developments that kind of emulate the urban core, right? Because that's just like, it's better for Instagram, it's better for Snapchat, you know, part of that experience of how you're engaging a space translates into the businesses that I think we want to support too.
I mean, one of the things though, that when you talk about fewer strip malls, I think, well, then that's probably fewer chains, fewer big box stores, potentially less tax revenue for that. I mean, cities are in some ways reluctant to give up that kind of tax revenue, aren't they? Isn't that the trade-off?
I think everybody's reluctant to give up tax revenue, but I think it is a trade-off. I don't know specifically if it means less tax revenue if these spaces just look differently than they did before. You know, like Eric was talking about, you know, some of this could maybe have more housing than would have been on these types of development before, or other things that I think are tax revenue gaining developments.
Maria, you were skeptical when I was saying, well, you have to give up tax revenue. No?
No, I don't think so. And when you look at the suburbs that are doing the best in terms of attracting millennials, you can look towards Hopkins, for example.
Okay.
They have put a lot of effort over many years into holding on to their downtown and not allowing chain stores, big box stores, to take up space in that downtown area. And now we're seeing that that's really a destination for people. A lot of millennials live there, can see themselves living there, because Hopkins has an identity. It's developed that core. People feel like it has a center. And I think it's giving it a competitive advantage over other suburbs.
Eric, what is a suburb like Shakopee? I mean, you have a fair number of big box stores and strip malls there, don't you?
We do, yeah.
They attract a lot of people to come drive to one place to shop.
They do.
This kind of a love-hate relationship with the big box and the strip mall for a city like yours?
I think so. And again, I think that's about balance. You know, people appreciate the convenience.
Right.
But they want a place. They want a unique experience. And that's what we're hearing in our community. You know, we also, while we're a suburb and growing, we were founded in the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
We're a historic city on the Minnesota River. We have a historic downtown. And we're hearing a lot from our community, millennials especially, that they want to see investment in the downtown. They like that it's a unique place that not all suburbs have. And so while they don't necessarily want the big boxes to go away,
yeah,
I think they want us to find a way to strike an appropriate balance where we have a strong downtown, but then also big boxes that are unique, maybe have some restaurants and other places for people to hang out, to gather. And they want to see stronger design. They want to see big boxes that look nice, that have parking lots that are well landscaped, and that maybe have sidewalks or bike trails where they can access those.
You've hit on something that I wanted to talk about, which is this idea of design. How do you come back to the idea of a destination downtown where you don't design the life out of it? And I'm thinking of somewhere like Maple Grove. It's been a long time since I've been to that downtown, but it felt Disneyfied to me, not real. Who wants to chime in on this? What do you do about that when you want to design for authenticity?
Well, I think a piece of that is supporting local business. So you can have an authentic experience that's unique in the downtown, because that business is only in this one city.
Mm-hmm.
So cities can do a lot to support local businesses, startups, support entrepreneurs within their own communities to create a distinctive feeling downtown.
Terrence, what would you say?
I agree with that. I think experience does matter when people are spending their dollars today. If you have a limited number of dollars, you want to spend it in a place that I think at a very basic level, gives you a good feeling. So I think part of that is local businesses, as Maria mentioned, and then at places that I feel like you can gather, like Eric mentioned. And I think when places don't have those characteristics, I think they'll probably be more unsuccessful over time.
Yeah, Eric.
I think a place like Maple Grove represents innovation taking place that we're now kind of stuck with for a while.
What do you mean by that?
I think, yeah. You know, the development that occurred in Maple Grove, when that occurred, that was at the forefront for suburbs. That was an attempt.
That's a good point.
To create
right.
a place.
This is years ago.
Absolutely.
That they were trying to make this downtown out of nothing, but that's
right.
kind of what it felt like.
Absolutely. I think, and that's something that, you know, didn't occur for 40, 50, 60 years in the suburbs.
Uh-huh.
And so that, I think, was an attempt to create a place, maybe not totally hitting all the pieces. You know, maybe it did feel a little Disney,
mm-hmm.
a little too planned.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that planners, that developers, that real estate people are beginning to figure out. You know, it's going to be clunky for a while. I think we'll get there. I think, thankfully, the market, as far as like consumers go, are continuing to demand better design, better landscaping. And I think we'll continue to kind of learn as we go. Places like Excelsior and Grand in St. Louis Park really did hit the mark. And I know as planners, we all look to projects like that, either locally or nationally, and ask, how did you do that? What were your lessons learned, so that we don't have to recreate the wheel or make the same mistakes that they did?
What's the thing that you would say about Excelsior and Grand, about that community that, as you said, hit the mark? Why? I don't think I've ever been there.
From what I've heard, it was a lot of time. It's a lot of patience.
Okay.
Redevelopment is really complicated. It takes a lot of time. It
but
takes a lot of money.
What works about it now, in your view?
I think it's, you know, somewhat of what Maria was talking about in the other development. It's that mix of building, of people, of opportunities to gather, of unique shops.
Maria?
Yeah. And Excelsior and Grand really came out of an intensive community engagement process. So there was a lot of community buy-in into it. And I think it proved that you could build a mixed-use dense development in the suburbs and paved the way for a lot of development that has happened after.
So do you feel like the concept of density, this is the thing that a lot of people move to the suburbs to get away with, to get away from? You can reintroduce the idea of density if you do it in, I guess, this thoughtful way. Mm-hmm. And you can draw some people in to live in the suburbs, but live close next to each other the way they traditionally think of living in the city. Yeah?
Yeah. You know, I think that proximity to density, or and I don't want to say proximity to density, but proximity to things to do is really important.
Uh-huh.
I think people are considering what suburbs to move to. Say for me, I just want to use a national example. I grew up in Southern California, Irvine, California, which is kind of, I thought what maybe is a kind of a famous suburb where it's very like meticulously planned. They've got this great development called the Irvine Spectrum, which has like all these shops, and it really emulates this downtown core in almost a European manner, where it's really kind of focused on the pedestrian level.
Yeah.
It is kind of a paradise. Yeah, I recommend you go out there.
Okay.
but, you know, I think part of those lessons that I think in places like Irvine and places like Excelsior and Grand, you know, really that pedestrian scale level developments that feel more intimate than they do in the wide space. I think people choose houses in those places. And I think we should, as a region, accommodate a variety of different types of development, including larger lots, because that's just necessary if we need to recruit all the people that we need to. You know, some people want that. I think we can't just ignore that. But, you know, I think, you know, folks with kids, bicyclists, pedestrians all want to feel safe in these urban environments that we're in. And I think from an architectural level and an architectural framework, having something that feels a little bit more intimate seems more valued. You don't need to live there, but I want to be able to get there pretty easy.
So, Terrence, if I was a millennial, you know, mid-range, mid-income, can I buy a place, whether it's a condo or a house in Spectrum in Irvine, or have they priced me out?
Probably have priced you out at this point, right? Yeah. And that's I really like that you brought up that point, you know, kind of to the initial point that I made was, you know, as poverty is growing in the suburbs, and I think particularly it seems to be disproportionately affecting people of color all around the nation and in this region as well. But I don't think that we have to look at those things as negatives for suburbs to deal with. That's a dynamic that I think suburbs need to start dealing with. But I'd really think that those are opportunities, right? If you have all these folks coming into your suburbs pouring in,
right?
How can we invest in the different things that they have? A lot of those folks have ideas for businesses. A lot of those folks bring some more fullness to our schools. These don't have to be bad things, but we do need to accommodate them in a way that that essentially doesn't turn suburbs into the 70s versions of the cities,
exactly.
You know, where it exactly. was looked at these places that we just want to stay away from. And we have all these terms like inner city and that are kind of dog whistles more or less. But suburbs can do this well. And I think they have the space to do this well. And I think they're benefiting from having space to not let these dynamics be burdens.
This is good. You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable about the suburbs of the future and why they are not the white, bland, boring suburbs that you associate from the 70s and 80s. But how are they being planned? Why are they attractive to some millennials? How are they encompassing the idea of sustainability? Talking this hour with Eric Weiss. He's a long-range planner for the city of Shakopee. C. Terrence Anderson, equity manager for the Met Council, and Maria Warduko. She's a transportation planner for Alta Planning based in Minneapolis. Terrence, I want to come back to you on this report that I was reading. I thought this was surprising. Immigrants to some of our largest cities never settle in the city. They go right to the suburbs. And I think you can see that in the small business growth in suburbs like Apple Valley and Woodbury. What does that mean, though, for understanding how suburbs are going to respond to that and embrace that? Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're there yet. What do you think about that?
I think that's a good question. You know, I think sometimes we forget, because a lot of places where immigrants or refugees settle are in cities oftentimes, and I think historically that has been the case. You know, if you look at the history of New York City and all, you know, all the immigration that had to do there. But I think, you know, right now, particularly in the Twin Cities, a lot of immigrants and refugees come from more rural communities. And so coming into a city environment isn't necessarily what they always desire.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that places that fit their, you know, folk places where they came from are our suburbs and exurban and rural communities. And so I think cities will, you know, as those groups come in, they're going to have different ideas about what urban design looks like, what different ideas of what safety looks like, different ideas of what these places to gather could look like, because I think they're naturally going to want to desire places like home. I think that's true for all of us. So I think that, you know, as cities are doing more community engagement, I think that's a very fashionable thing to do right now. I'd be very interested to see if they're doing focus groups on any of these particular developments, how they may differ from what is traditional or historically have been quote unquote American as new groups are becoming part of America.
Maria, that turn up in any of your research?
Yeah, I think developers and cities are thinking more about multi-generational housing and mm-hmm. how to accommodate larger families with grandparents and children and cousins, and that can be more typical of some immigrant families that we see in this area. But I think on the community engagement front, cities are struggling to figure out how to engage their diverse communities. So engagement still primarily draws from older white homeowners. And cities are certainly trying to expand their community engagement to get more perspectives, but we're still not seeing these suburbs and the developments in these suburbs shaped by people of color, immigrants, younger people.
I thought you had a really good point about when we talk about millennials, we often think college educated, and this is a highly educated generation. But that's not, I think you said the majority of millennials don't have a college degree yet. These are people that are maybe making their lives in the suburbs. What does that mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So our generation is the most highly educated. A lot of formal education relative to other generations, but it is true that the majority of millennials still do not have a college degree. And when cities are thinking about attracting millennials, they're often thinking more of a young professional.
Okay.
When there are millennials who are working in the service industry, people all across the income spectrum.
I mean, this goes to the immigrant family too, right? Getting your start, right? Maybe working on a degree, but not into that professional level yet.
Mm-hmm, so. Exactly. So I think we need to do a better job of designing for all different types of millennials, and not focusing purely on the upper middle class professional.
So specifically, what does that mean?
So that means looking at connecting people in your community to the jobs that are there rather than just trying to attract professionals from outside the community, investing in education to develop the people who live within your community so that they can take on those jobs that are available.
What do you think that means in a place like Shakopee, Eric?
I agree. I think it's about expanding the conversation. It's about, again, adding more tools into that toolbox and really thinking through how are we recognizing that one size does not fit all and that we need to be expanding the conventional wisdom, the conversation, to include a larger segment of the population, and a recognition that the population is no longer two parents and two families,
mm-hmm.
or two kids.
Yeah. You were talking about the tension that comes up with these planned places. And again, we've been admiring of some of these, the new design that's coming into some of these places. But the fact that that gets expensive pretty fast, and maybe it prices too many people out. What have you seen about that?
Sure. I think in neighborhoods where there's a good mix of retail, where there's sidewalks and there's bike lanes, it can price people out. I think that's a symptom of the fact that we have built suburbs in one way, that there's a pent-up demand for healthier places where people can gather, where they feel welcomed. I think that means that we need to go all in on that. I think it means that we don't stop doing that, that we really need to invest in those types of infrastructure, of those types of places that will create healthier communities, safer communities, because everyone wants that. That's what people want, and so that's what we should be building. Hopefully, if we build enough of those, and it's available to all, we'll begin to see a reduction in pricing people out.
Jared? Yeah, you know, I think kind of imagining what does servicing not just college-educated millennials and building suburbs that accommodate them is, I think in the past, you know, I grew up in a very, you know, kind of white-collar suburb in California, and that's, I think, how most folks view suburbs
yeah.
as being.
Still.
Yeah, still, you know, and so a lot of them are. But I think it's also true that we have to look at where are the high-growth areas of the economy and where do we need workers, right? So I think one of the things that we know in the Twin Cities is that we're going to have a worker shortage, or we already have a worker shortage. And a lot of those jobs are not white collar jobs. And so I think that, you know, thinking about how suburbs in the school plan for the workforce in the future, I think is important. You know, the council, we, you know, shout out to the council. We need more bus drivers. We need more interceptor service workers. And those are very well paying jobs that can support being able to purchase homes and have a high quality of life in suburbs. Not all those folks are just going to end up in the cities like they may, like we think about may have
right.
happened in the past. And so I think that's a very important point. And I think suburbs often, I think, try to emulate, you know, the ones that we think about, you know, Edina or, you know, all these, you know, Eagan, or all these places that I think rightfully deserve good reputations in this regard. But I think you have to think about it more complexly about what are these students or who these kids that are coming out of these places going to do in the future too.
So Maria, now to you on transportation, because this is your bread and butter. This is what you do. And I have to admit, love where I live, did not think about transit when I moved out there, wish I had. So how do suburbs, not just the first rings, but the second rings, deal with the idea that everybody shouldn't hop in their car and drive in by themselves like I do every day? How do you accommodate all of that?
Yeah, well, what we're seeing now is that people demand transportation choices.
Mm-hmm.
So they want the ability to drive, to walk, to bicycle, to use transit.
And it still feels like you have to live pretty close to the city to get that.
In a lot of cases, I think that's true. But there are things that suburbs are doing to become more walkable.
Okay.
For example, you can retrofit a neighborhood that has a lot of cul-de-sacs to link the cul-de-sacs to the neighboring cul-de-sacs or streets by sidewalks or trails. So
mm-hmm.
you're retrofitting, creating a grid that creates shorter trips for people who are walking or biking.
What about getting into jobs? I mean, how about transportation? Isn't that mostly what people are looking for is, how do I get high capacity transit so that I don't have to take my car on every trip, especially to my job. Mm-hmm. What are suburbs doing about that?
Well, if you look at Southwest Transit, for example, mm-hmm. They are making a concerted effort to have comfortable buses that take people from those suburbs into downtown Minneapolis. So people who want to have that opportunity to take transit to their job and not have to sit in traffic or worry about parking are attracted to those suburbs that are investing in transit service.
I mean, this is the thing that I think of as driving more people out of the second, you know, as far out on the fringes as you can go and back into maybe closer suburban living or into the city. Terrence, yes?
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, if poverty is growing in the suburbs, which it is, you know, if more folks, you know, as folks get older, they tend to develop a disability. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of services really need to be imagining themselves in suburban spaces to meet the needs out there. And one of the big things that we're finding out is, you know, cost. We need to always thinking about in what's the cost of housing, but also the cost of transportation to get to the things
right.
of necessity.
Right.
And it's just as a matter of geometry, it's hard to provide efficient services to suburbs. Right? It's just hard. It's just hard to have transit that takes you all to all the places that it needs to take you in a way that it's also cognizant of, you know, our limits of resources at transit.
Right.
So I think that's a growing problem that suburbs are going to have to deal with. Folks like the Met Council, Metro Transit are going to have to deal with. And where people are locating within these different spaces, I think city, you know, places like Shakopee are going to have to be pretty mindful of.
How do you figure that in the planning, Eric?
So we're having some really great conversations in Scott County. There's an initiative called Live, Learn, Earn, which is a recognition that, you know, we have a mismatch between our housing systems, our transportation systems. And so for us, our conversations about transportation is not in one silo. We recognize that we can't just have a conversation about the infrastructure and our cars, our buses. We have to have a larger conversation that includes housing, that includes workforce development, that includes education, because they all impact each other. Our cities are complicated things, organisms, and we can't just address one piece of that and expect that we're going to solve it fully. So we can't plan for, as Terrence was mentioning, you can't think about a transit system without thinking about the housing development that goes along with it. If you just don't have enough people in an area, the transit just won't work. It's too expensive. And so we can't just think about providing transit without also thinking about how do we think about where the jobs are? How do we think about the housing? How do we think about education and workforce development?
Is that, I also noted here that you're the vice president of the American Planning Association. So is that a new way for planners to get into this idea about what it's going to mean to live in the suburbs and how transit fits into that?
Absolutely. I think there's been a major evolution in the field of planning in the last 25 years. I think there's a growing recognition that we can't address things in silos, that we have to work in partnerships. You know, we can't just sit in our offices. We have to go out. We have to go talk to people. We have to talk to the community. We have to work with engineers. We have to work with elected officials. Cities can't, you know, they don't have jurisdiction over the school district, mm-hmm. but we rely on each other for success. Shakopee is only going to be successful if its school district is successful and vice versa. So I just had a meeting with the Shakopee High School principal yesterday to talk about issues and look for ways that we can partner together.
What did the principal tell you that will influence the, you know, what you take back to your planning?
Well, we're actually talking about engaging the students and hearing from them what they want to
really?
See for the future of Shakopee. They're the ones that are likely to be there the longest. So
that's right.
We want to hear from them what would keep them in Shakopee and what they like about Shakopee and what they see we should be working on.
Okay. I end many roundtables by asking you what you're reading. And Terrence, you brought a book with you. So I'm coming to you first. What'd you bring and why are you reading it? What is
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So I'm reading The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein.
Uh-huh.
It's a wonderful book that kind of talks about the history of how governments created America, particularly segregated America. So I think one of the great things about this conversation about suburbs that we have to bring into it is how did they come into existence in the first place?
Uh-huh.
You know, recognizing that segregation wasn't just de facto. It didn't just happen because it happened, but there were policies that we have to address over time in order if we want good, equitable communities.
And so understanding the history of that so that it doesn't repeat itself in the kind of planning and decision-making that's going on.
Right.
The book is called The Color of Law?
Color of Law, that's correct.
Okay, good. Maria, what are you reading?
Well, I've been trying to read fiction these days, give myself a little bit of a break.
Excellent.
But I just finished reading The Circle, which is a book that was made into a movie recently.
Okay.
Imagines a dystopian future focusing on a social media company that slowly grows to more or less take over the world. So I've been thinking some about digital privacy and how much we share online and that kind of thing.
Do we live in suburbs in that dystopian future?
Well, most of the employees lived on the campus, so.
Pretty soon our employers own us.
Yes.
We have no lives outside. Oh, my gosh. What have you been reading, Eric?
Well, like Maria, I also need to take a little break from my daily world.
Good.
And so I've actually.
Fiction is perfect for that.
In true millennial fashion, I've been going back and reading X-Men comic books from my
childhood. Oh, have you? Why?
And doing that on my iPad. So just as stereotypical
That's
as it comes.
Great. That's great. Okay, what are you learning from those X-Men comic books that you're going back to?
Well, actually, the X-Men are fantastic. They really pushed the boundaries and were a representation of issues related to race and gay rights and other human rights. So
I had no idea.
You should do a Friday roundtable. I'll come back. We'll talk all about it.
Okay. I challenge accepted. Really good idea. Okay. Which is your favorite comic book of the whole series?
Well, I just like the traditional X-Men.
Okay.
Favorite characters are Rogue, Gambit, and Beast.
Okay. This is not how I thought this roundtable would end, but that's even better. Hey, thank you all for a good conversation about the suburbs of the future.